Hi, I'm Friday Afternoon Deploy, and for a lot of my career, I've been writing JavaScript.
Thank you, Friday Afternoon Deploy.
Thanks for sharing.
I missed it. I wasn't recording in time. Alex,
it's okay.
You wanted that committed to, yeah. to the
yeah, yeah, I
did. The internals of the internet. We're talking vices today.
Yay.
Is that our topic? I don't think so.
No.
I don't think we should.
People would
there.
Like it if it was, though.
Probably.
Yeah.
Maybe.
PG admin, that's a vice for some folks.
Oh, what an awful one.
I know.
That's self-destructive vice.
I know. I had to just set that up just now for those folks that have that vice.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. So I had to navigate the PG admin to figure out how to do the thing.
We have a new client here, and the CTO, like, what did Tyrell say? He said, find a man that looks at you the way so-and-so looks at PostGIS. Because,
mm-hmm.
man, are they fans. It's cool, though.
Yeah.
It's cool stuff.
Yeah, it is.
I don't know if
it is.
Yeah, if anyone's ever worked with GIS stuff with PostGIS, it's actually pretty sweet.
Cool.
They've taken maps and condensed it into a two-dimensional data format that you can
nice.
Query in a database.
That's cool.
You know, select star from table where latitude and longitude is in this huge polygon with 30,000 points, and just does it.
Nice.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
We don't actually have a topic today.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
We usually don't.
Which means we're probably going to end up defaulting devices or something like that.
Well, maybe we can pull it out like we did the last one.
And the one before that. And the one before that, too.
Yeah, there's only been like four that we've come in with a plan.
I'll say we're on a chain. This is this is episode 41.
Oh,
episode 40 was last week.
We're crazy.
Closing in on a year of
That's
doing this.
Really crazy.
That is crazy.
Yeah. And you know, and less thanklessly now. Which is great.
I'm not sure
how many weeks we did this show before we actually heard from a listener. It's like, oh, they're out there. That's great. We hear a lot these days, though.
And outside of NWA Slack.
That's true. Outside of our local like regional Slack channel, which is where we first kind of launched the thing. Only like half of our maybe 60% of our traffic comes from the U.S.
Really?
So we're international.
That's crazy.
No big deal.
No big deal.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. On this note, I do get to call out. We have a new patron, Glenn Paquette from Northern Ontario. I won't embarrass him by reading the note that he sent to us, but
it was very appreciated.
No, super. It was almost kind of touching.
Very much so.
So,
yeah.
Man, we're really glad that you enjoy the show and that we can kind of contribute to, getting you the opportunity to hear developers talk shit and be toxic about their work all day, like you would have in a tech company.
Yeah.
But yeah,
and we're not too far from being isolated here. You know, I mean, I get it. I grew up in Winslow.
This is
30 miles from now.
We're the nowhere developers, Alan.
Haven't you heard? Exactly.
Don't get me started.
That's a local inside joke. Some of you will get that.
Are you going to DjangoCon?
No. Okay. Glenn asked if we would, and we're not, which is totally a bummer. It's coming
a scheduling thing.
It's coming up soon. I've got a trip. I'm actually going to be in Utah when that show is going on, and everyone else has just jumped into a couple of vacation stuff. Just didn't work out this year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We gotta
I'm a JavaScript
go back,
developer,
though.
So I definitely won't be there.
You won't be at DjangoCon?
No.
That's weird. I thought you guys liked Jamie Foxx.
That's
what I was told at the check-in counter one time at DjangoCon. Yeah.
Yeah.
We need to go back. I haven't been in it's actually been a while. I've been to PyCon twice since I've been to DjangoCon.
Yeah.
Which is too bad.
In the vein of that joke, though.
Let's hear it.
I miss I miss, that's kind of sarcastic actually, but I miss that window right when that movie came out, and it just screwed up all of my Googling for any kind of Django help, because used to you just type Django,
yeah,
and that's the first thing that came up.
Yeah,
they're like, you're
a little bit of gypsy jazz guitar might get snuck in based on your search history.
Which isn't unwelcome to me. Right, I'm all right. Like, oh yeah, Django Reinhardt's awesome, but yeah, show me the framework right now that incidentally is named after him, so that made more sense. And then and then there was like a year or two of Jamie Foxx comes up. You want to stream Django Unchained.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you? That movie's great.
It is. I remember actually.
Have you seen the first one? It's actually a remake. There's a 1970s. There's a couple of them. Django Unchained.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. It's more hardcore. He drags.
More hardcore.
He's chained to a coffin that he carries around. This is like Civil War, so nobody really questions it. They're just like, yeah, shit's weird. and he carries this coffin around that has a Gatling gun in it. And so he'll like whip out the Gatling gun and just mow folks down.
Which also no one questioned.
Right, yeah. Wow, okay. Yeah.
It's the West.
I need to see that.
Yeah. It's an obscure cult film that I had found, because that's what Amazon Prime Video does. They're all like, hey, we found these that the royalties are real cheap for.
Mm-hmm.
And here's one, because Django is popular right now. And I'm all like, what? That was a remake? Of course it was.
Yeah. I have not seen the original.
It's not really a remake, because Quentin tells a new story with it, but it's, yeah.
Yeah, I don't imagine Quentin Tarantino doing a shot-for-shot reboot of anything.
Right. Right.
But I am surprised to hear that it was more hardcore.
Yeah.
Because that's hard to imagine.
Yeah. Like that. That's what I feel like he probably saw those, like those that had an impact, and he was like, I want to make a really brutal Western like that.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, I think we've talked about four spaghetti Westerns, which, you know, and so they're like that. They're in that vein, but they're much more hardcore than Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, and Good, the Bad, the Ugly.
Yeah.
Okay. I like some good spaghetti Western.
Has anyone seen the new Tarantino movie?
Which one?
What is it? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Nope.
No, I haven't seen that one.
Hateful
Eight's the last one I've seen.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
What did you think about that one?
It was all right.
It was way too long.
It was like Reservoir Dogs frontier version.
Yeah, yeah, but not as
and long not as shit. Good. Yeah. Nobody got their ears cut off.
Yeah, so. Not as good as Reservoir Dogs. Reservoir Dogs is classic.
It is. It's good, because it all takes place basically in one room.
Yeah, like, in that warehouse. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a long time since I've seen that one.
I've never
been a huge Quentin Tarantino fan. I'll just come right out and say it.
That's fine.
I like taking these kind of opposition viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not a fan.
Yeah, that's kind of actually
just never
the way
got
I
swept
am.
Up in it.
I watch every one of them, but they're not. I don't own any of them, like on DVD, going back that far.
I don't think
but I've seen almost every one of them.
I don't think I've seen, what was the World War II one?
Inglourious Bastards.
Inglourious Bastards. I don't think I've seen
that one's pretty great.
Well, that's one of the best, I think.
Yeah,
it's way up there.
Put it on my list.
Buongiorno.
Yeah.
That one.
Man,
yeah,
Brad
that's
Pitt
good.
That is
yeah.
so good.
Yeah.
See, this shouldn't be a surprise. You guys know that. We've talked about this so many times. I don't watch movies. I suck at watching movies.
Except for Star Wars. Yeah.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah.
That's not a movie.
Oh,
that's an experience.
That's a lifestyle.
That's basically modern. That's our modern day like mythology for today's
exactly.
day.
Exactly.
Like,
I agree.
Yeah.
That's my Mount Olympus.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Same. Yeah.
It's like I don't write. I'm not a programmer. I don't write code. I write in Django. I write Python. Like, I am a lifestyle.
That's right.
That's right.
It's you know, it's not a job, man. I mean, if you want to put it in the box,
mm-hmm.
but speaking of code,
we've
been known to dabble,
and so,
talk about
so
it.
So I have a question then.
Okay. Lay it on me.
What is your coding vice?
Hmm.
Coding vice.
JetBrains.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. That's a good one.
JetBrains and all their products. Like, I found out that I've been spoiled by DataGrip and can't use pgAdmin.
Yeah. pgAdmin's a piece of garbage.
It is. I don't even use DataGrip that much. Like, if I'm interacting with Postgres, I use PSQL usually.
Yeah.
honestly. But DataGrip's awesome because you can connect to any RDS. That's what I've been doing all day. Any relational database, right, though, through it. It's got all the engines. So that's pretty awesome.
Even like other non-relational. You can do NoSQL through it.
I just never do that.
It's plug-in based. I found a plug-in once and used it for Cassandra.
Mm. That's cool.
Which was very helpful.
Yeah.
Because Cassandra is a fucking quagmire. Nobody knows how that shit works.
Dude, Cassandra is awesome.
It's cool.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong.
Is it, though?
I mean, for what it's supposed to do, yeah, it's great.
It's hard. It's hard to model data with it.
It's just different, right? Like, it's read optimized. So you have to put things in there a certain way.
And you have to think about how you're going to shard it. Like, how am I going to access this data layer later?
In threes, right?
Like, yeah. And make sure that all of the data that needs to be joined is all sitting on the same shard.
Yeah.
Mm. Which is tough. And I don't know if the tooling's gotten better or if it's even like, I don't know if it was my naivety or the tooling didn't exist. Or if it's just like a law of thermodynamics within that design of that database. But back in the day, once you fucked that up and you had your shard keys wrong, your only option was to just nuke it. I'm sure you can stand up a second cluster and write some sort of migration and stuff.
Well, that's kind of how I started doing Elasticsearch.
Yeah. Elasticsearch is that way. I mean, you can apply new mappings, but even when you use like a hosted, like from Elastic, and you want to do stuff like that, fuck it. Here's a second cluster. We'll migrate the data for you and shut the old one down.
Yeah.
It tends to be the easier way to operate it. I don't want to misrepresent. Yeah. I don't know Cassandra well at all. You may well be able to just do schema migrations, or I didn't know how to do it, and there didn't seem to be a lot of resources. I haven't touched it in like 2 years, though.
Yeah.
To be fair.
Yeah. It's been a while for me too. But we definitely have used it. And it had advantages and disadvantages.
So what did you use it for?
Yeah.
What was the use case?
As specific as
that made you say, you know what? MongoDB doesn't guarantee writes, and for some reason I still use it. But in this case, I need to use Cassandra.
MongoDB wasn't an option. We had constraints on what databases we could use.
Got it. So this is like a client constraint.
Yeah, and we did need something. We needed something that would
work.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
And that would scale.
Yeah.
Much more quickly than SQL.
Yeah.
Just a traditional SQL server.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Because we were wanting to store, there were going to be like millions and millions and millions of writes to this thing. So, right. And then reading a lot, like if you wrote a million times, you would read many more times than that. So,
got it.
Read heavy. Yeah, read heavy.
You didn't need every read to be perfectly accurate as to the minute you needed it to be eventually complete.
Yeah.
If you're doing aggregate, that's where a lot of people use Cassandra, is to be able to do aggregations that don't have to be precise. Things like counting 26 million upvotes on a YouTube video.
So
I don't need the precise number. If it's the number from 5 minutes ago and that data is still cascading across the cluster, that's okay.
And so that was the original understanding of the problem. And then I think last year they migrated it to MariaDB.
Oh, really?
Mm. Mm. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
So is Maria not full-on SQL, though? Isn't it just
is.
Like a...
Okay. Yeah, it is.
It's the open-source MySQL.
MySQL, right?
Yeah. So what we learned in that whole process was that Cassandra was awesome, but it was also overkill.
Got it.
Because for what we wanted to... the way that we sort of had things, we had to have 18 nodes up.
Wow.
And it was insane.
Yeah.
Because you had to replicate it 3 times. And so we had clusters of 6 and we had 3 of them.
Good and start getting that $1,500 a month Cassandra bill starts.
Crazy expensive. So now I think they are on like 3 SQL servers or something. Wow. So
still that's a beast. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't talk about it too much, but I can tell you more classified about it offline. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you should have been here for last week's episode when we got deep into classified intel.
Yeah.
I have to apologize for our hosts for the awkward setup in the new and improved Friday Afternoon Deploy Studio. I could tell immediately the awkwardness of you having to talk to Alan.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. I had it over there.
Need to get you a mirror so you can look at the table
diagonal.
I actually had the couch diagonal, but I think the table diagonal. Alex and I sat in here the other morning.
Yeah.
I just haven't had time to figure it out.
Yeah,
but I think look, we could our it mic out. Stands are actually clamped.
I like the table. Yeah,
it's
like
quite
it.
An upgrade.
Yeah,
it's a standing desk. Alex can really throw us for a loop by raising the table up and down. Be careful with the buttons.
Yeah.
Okay, so Alex, what is your coding vice?
My coding vice, I think it's fair for me to say that polymorphism is my coding vice.
Okay.
Whenever I see an if else statement, I have to really calm myself down and just be like, it's okay.
You get triggered.
I get triggered hard, especially case statements, if else, and lots of type checking everywhere just hurts me. I immediately want to make it polymorphic and start creating lots of files with lots of classes that I can dynamically create objects with.
Yeah.
And then I have to tell myself, they're not adding to this. They're not. They don't need this.
Yeah.
But it still it upsets me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it feels really cool when you actually do it in a situation that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Cool. That's awesome.
Not a bad one.
That was a good answer.
Not a bad advice, I don't think.
No.
I don't know if I have one.
JetBrains.
That was Alan.
Yeah. Alan. Okay.
Yeah. The tooling
Within Python, it's definitely some of the Python syntactic sugar. List comprehensions, very guilty pleasure. I have abused list comprehensions many times.
Yeah.
But like generally speaking, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't do anything well. Maybe that's my vice is half-assing it or something.
Having a broad knowledge base, but not specializing in any.
Yeah. But having no depth.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. That's why
I picked a tool.
Yeah.
What about Blake?
JavaScript?
I can think of two. Lodash is one, which is a...
Ooh, I know amazing. Lodash.
Which is, it's a library that...
It's a standard library for JavaScript.
Kind of, yeah. But now a lot of the things that are in Lodash are in the standard library.
Oh, okay.
And it's actually, for a time, Lodash was actually faster. Like, if you mapped, Lodash was faster just because of the way it was implemented. But now that's not the case anymore.
That really wasn't a dig at JavaScript. I mean, I used Lodash a lot too because it was like, I have a map function. I have all kinds of array operations.
Yeah, collection. It's a habit at this point.
Yeah.
And you can, the chaining of methods is like, method chaining is probably my vice because I absolutely love it. That's why one of the reasons I love promises more than async await is because
method chaining,
the method chaining things together.
I gotta
tell you, satisfying.
That is a vice.
Yeah,
because that was brought to us by the Mootools and Prototype JS generation.
Yeah.
Who was drunk on method chaining. Just absolutely shit-faced on method chaining. And it would just be like, I've got to check out this button on click, animate, fade, do that, blah, blah, blah. Just 40, just chained out. Yeah.
So great.
Yeah.
But it really does affect your whole programming style because you can't, you have to be very consistent in your adherence to the functional programming principles of one type in, one type out, always the same type, or you can't do the chaining.
Yep. Right? I do feel like it's also really easy to read. I always really appreciate when I read someone else that has done it, and it's
very prose-like.
And it's like, it's easy to tell what's happening, especially if the methods or functions are named well. It's like, now I'm going to do this, now I'm going to do this. And then I would have to say the other thing that really gets me, it's similar to the polymorphism thing a little bit, but or it involves if else. I can't stand else at all.
Yeah.
In Java, I do the implicit else, which is if you have an if statement, return in the if statement, and then outside of it, you can have a return, which is an implicit else.
Yeah. We do that sometimes in Python. My vice though might be the if and else. statement. Yeah. I like a good if, LF, LF.
You should have been here, Blake, for the flow control episode. We talked about that. Man, we had a whole episode on flow control.
Yeah. Yep.
That might be the most
technical
and like pointed topical episode we've ever done.
That's one of the planned ones. We came in knowing
we knew what to do.
Yeah.
We didn't come in talking,
Yeah.
Substance vices.
If I have to do like more than two ifs, so like if something, and then return something. If I have to do more than that, I'll like 100% of the time write a case, a switch.
See, we don't have
or make
those.
A new method, right? You'll do something. You'll do something else.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. I just try to avoid it. Like yes. Right.
I understand.
I will think very hard about ways to work around it.
I can think of two gnarly if else blocks in a code base that I have right now.
I love it. Like it's impacted you such that like I'm thinking of two specific if else statements.
If given the time, I could probably go back and I could use a dictionary. Somehow that's basically how we can do a case switch in Python.
Okay.
Yeah.
But hash this map. One, to my credit, to in my defense, though, like it's very simple what it's doing in there. Like mm-hmm. That's where I don't like a lot of logic inside an if statement.
For sure.
Like, but it's pretty much like a factory. Like if this is true, then call this function. If this is true, call that function. Yeah. If this is true, call that function. And that's why I could probably convert it to a dictionary, I'm sure. And just,
you could just map.
Yeah.
Even talking about it, like if it's this, then do that. If you're this type, then do that. It upsets me. It upsets me deeply. I want to just say, give me the object and do this. And you know your type, do it. Just duck typing is so deeply ingrained in me.
Yeah.
I want to just create these type classes.
Well, it might not be duck typing. I don't know specifically what.
Yeah, don't know that exact scenario.
Yeah.
But
could be if value is greater than this.
Right.
Or if it's less than this and like those kind of situations.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's why it's my vice. Like I hear it now. Yeah.
Totally fair.
And I think absolutely like, there's always you have to be practical. And sometimes it's like, making everything look great and read great and perfect is not a luxury that you have. And sometimes you write ugly if else just to get it done.
Yeah.
You know what you tell yourself when you're doing that and you find yourself writing ugly code, just know that someone out there is writing PHP. It could be worse.
That's true.
Could be worse. You could be writing a WordPress plugin.
There was this one instance on our project once that I was reviewing a PR. This triggered me so hard. There were eight if blocks in one function. It was like if like eight times. Whew, that was bad.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did the guy very strongly defend it?
Oh yeah.
It
was easier to read, and so then I rewrote it in like a reduce, and it was like four lines.
Amazing. How mad was he?
He wasn't that type of person.
Wasn't that type of person? I have that type of person
on this
project.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah.
We're both triggered now.
Got some PTSD there.
So there's something I want to explore, which is, Alex, you and Blake used to work together at the same company. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That is correct.
How long ago was that?
A couple years.
Has it been 2 years now?
I think it's getting close to that.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. Because I've been at Revudit 3.5. So
that checks out.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. That's it. That's the inspiration.
We did.
No, but did you guys work on projects together or?
No.
Mm-mm.
No, we were always on different projects because when I started at Revudit, they were mostly. They just still did a lot of Ruby and Rails at that point, and that was your jam.
Yep.
And I was I've always been the JavaScript guy. So
yeah. We used to sit across from each other.
Yeah.
For a while.
Yeah, we did.
So
yeah.
Talk a lot. But
yeah, for sure.
I mean, because they were doing a lot of Rails then. Did you like really bring JavaScript to that? Because they're all in on it now, right?
Yeah, like now we are absolutely 100% a JavaScript shop. I don't think it was me. I'm not going to take credit for that.
I bet you had a
big
to do with that.
They were like, we need a thing. And you were like, all right, well, it's going to be in JavaScript if that's what you
got
to do.
So before I got there.
It was the mobile development.
Yeah, it was really Ionic.
Can we say Ionic?
Yeah.
Okay, then it was Ionic that made the hard shift.
Yeah, it was. And then they let them do the API or the orchestration for that in Node, and that was the beginning. Was before me.
Oh, okay.
That was about 5 months before I started.
Okay. Hmm. I was looking back on it and remembering when you went there and knowing that you were super into JavaScript.
Yeah.
I thought at that time they were still a Rails shop.
We'd speculate.
They were majority.
There was this transitional period where they were trying to figure out what type of projects they really wanted to build.
Yeah.
And with the when I started, it was all Rails, and the idea was doing responsive websites.
Right.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to build a mobile application because you could build a mobile-friendly
website. Yeah.
Website.
Yeah.
And it worked, but it was really expensive for people.
Yeah.
And so they found that if they used Ionic, then they could build. Ionic is technically a web app still. Yeah. But you get more of a native mobile feel.
You can interact with the device. Yeah, you can bridge to the native elements.
Exactly.
And it performed did you guys deploy it with Cordova?
Cordova.
So Cordova did perform really well.
Yeah, I mean, it was
like the animations and things like that.
It depended on what you were doing.
Okay.
Just like we were talking about earlier with React Native, it really depends on what you're doing.
Mm.
If you're like making a game or something, just write the native code. If you're building clickable lists, use something easy and don't write it in two different languages.
Right.
And I think, to Alex's point, I think at that point, there was sort of an inflection point where RevUnit started getting larger customers and started doing more enterprise work. And for whatever reason, I think Node started to gain popularity in those environments way more than Ruby.
That's fair, yeah.
And I think that was part of the shift as well.
Got it.
I think if our customers were like, you need to write this in Rails, that's what they would have done.
Right.
Mm. But it was like, we need you to write a thing, and we need you to hire 8 people by the end of next week. And it's like, man, Rails, it's hard to find people, so there's a lot more JavaScript people around. Let's just do that.
Right.
Yeah.
So...
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That was the full exploration of that. Oh. But I was excited about getting you guys both on the show.
Yeah.
The last.
Oh, that's right. We haven't done that yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The last project that I was on at RevUnit, I did JavaScript for a long time. That was all I wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds like my last project at RevUnit. I wrote JavaScript once.
Once.
One time.
I was out.
Oh, no.
Show me the door.
This is where I come out. I'm a secret JavaScript developer.
Oh.
Technically, my Ruby experience.
How did he get through the screening here?
It technically only... outpaces my JavaScript experience by about a year and a half. And my JavaScript learning has been in tandem.
I love it.
The whole time.
You hide it very well.
Thank you.
That's because everyone is secretly a JavaScript developer.
Everyone is an obligatory JavaScript developer.
I was going to say that, that's funny you say that. If I'm honest with myself, I love that I have to make it like that. Like it's...
Mm-hmm.
I murder puppies in my spare time. But if I'm honest with myself, I'm pretty much the same. No, it's even worse.
I've written JavaScript, longer than I've written
yeah, Python.
For sure.
Okay, good. We can unite on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is a safe space, Alan.
Okay.
It's just the four of us.
Yeah.
No however listening. Many other people listen to this show.
Okay. Now that that we're all JavaScript developers, do you like? Do you like prototype more than class syntax or class syntax more?
I'm fine with class as long as you're not doing inheritance.
Yeah, because you can't really. Hopefully,
No. You can. But after you go one level deep, shit starts getting weird, man.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I like about the prototypical inheritance is that there is no inheritance.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
You're it makes it really hard to do it because you're not supposed to do it.
You can do it, but you can't do it.
So, and I think honestly, like,
I just don't do it. That's what I figured out. For me, JavaScript is it's a functional language.
Yeah, yeah, that's how I treat it as well. That's what I was about to say. That's how I treat it. I almost never write classes. I almost never, you know, even when I'm writing React, like. With now, especially, you can use things like hooks to contain state within a functional component. So it's really, really rare that I'm going to write a class in JavaScript. There was this library that I was using for a little bit I think it was Happy, which is a backend framework in Node.
Yes.
Yep.
And
Hoppy. So
it's okay.
It's only one P.
By some dude that I think Walmart hired, and
I'm pretty sure it was developed by Walmart Labs out in California.
No, it was separate, and then they hired the dude.
Got it.
Pretty sure. I was using this library, and it was just really cool. Like every 5 seconds or so, it would log out basically the stats of your node processes, like how much memory and. Mm. And it was kind of hard to find that same thing for Express. So I was looking at the library and I was like, this shouldn't be very hard to do in Express. But it was written in classes. And so I rewrote it all in functions. Yeah. Because nice. I was like, I don't like this. So
yeah.
I miss that old syntax like that. The just, you know, this function basically now it's my new prototype and all the this is.
Well, what I like about the functions in JavaScript is they can hold properties on them.
Yeah. They're objects.
They're just objects that are callable.
Yeah.
So it's this weird functional object oriented syntax mixed together.
Yeah.
If you like that, you should love Python. Do you ever write Python, Blake?
I have before.
Yeah. Dabble in it?
Because
it's that. Everything's an object and you can do things like that, but you can also do inheritance when you want to.
Yep. Yeah.
You, at least your hands aren't tied.
Yeah. I have written some Python, mostly just like.
Don't tell me just like Bash script alternative glue.
Yeah.
That's what most people say.
Yeah.
Treat Python like Perl.
Mostly like a scripting, like, and it was for doing some API testing, like pen testing type stuff. It was a script to do that. Gotcha. Like generate the hash and authenticate with an API and then blah 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 blah.
Yep.
And
so now I have to know, why did you use Python to do that over doing it with
JavaScript? Yeah, so there was a really specific reason actually.
You needed a Python library.
No. We were having an app pen tested. The dude did not know Node, and we had to provide him a way to do it. So he knew Python. So we gave him a Python script to do it.
So what exactly what value was that person providing in this?
Well, that's questionable, but that's beside the point.
I pictured the Bobs from Office Space. Like, I'm pen testing. Yeah. Like, okay, so you write your own pen testing tools and test it. Like, well, no. Someone else writes the tools for me.
I just run them.
Oh, so you push the button. Well, no.
Yeah.
My secretary does that.
So this was like a really specific case to get like into this one client, like internal net. Like it was a kind of a clusterfuck to get it to get there. So if they had just had to do this themselves, it would have been probably a nightmare without any of the additional context that we had. So,
got it.
So it was like, let's do this. And you know, it'll make their life easier to make the whole thing go faster. Cause, pen testing was kind of a bear for us. A lot of times it would take, you know, a couple months. So you have a deadline. And it's like, oh, we got to get done a couple months before the actual deadline.
So that we can pen test and do remediation.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So that was the one case. Like I would write Python. I have no problems with writing Python.
Good to know.
It's a great language.
Yeah.
So forced, but...
It's popular. I mean, like, it's used everywhere. You can use it for everything, just about. And
if you want to tie your brain in knots and do async stuff, you can do that, too.
Yeah.
I'd have to, because that's how my brain works now.
Asyncs and awaits all over the place.
I actually think that's something that I struggled with a little bit, is like... the is like reading Python. It's like, oh, it just works this way. Like, this is just how, like, in the order in which you read it is the order in which it's executed. Holy shit. That's mind-blowing.
What a crazy concept.
That is mind-blowing.
It's almost sequential.
Yeah. I my brain absolutely works in total async mm-hmm. these days.
Well, we've explored that like a million times on the show, but the difference in those paradigms, I mean, it's not about languages, it's about thinking that way. Even like doing stuff with synchronous Python, but using tools for like cluster computing, mm-hmm. where you like have synchronous Python code executing asynchronously as like a background task, requires the same mental gymnastics for me as doing like async native in the language.
Yeah.
I can't count on that to be done by the time this starts.
Is that
okay?
Is that built into the language, or is it, do you have to have a library for that to like use it in an asynchronous manner?
Well, now it's built in. There's a
it's native, still better if you use a library.
What's the library called? Is it like Twisted or something
there
like
is,
that?
There is that. There's
Twisted is a server, I believe,
okay.
for like asynchronous web stuff.
Very, very low level. And
then there's Tornado on top of that, which is higher level.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so then Python 3.5, I think. Guido, the guy who invented Python, has really gone all in on async.io.
Async.io.
So that's the built-in library.
It's standard library Python.
Okay.
And it gives you async and await keywords and things like that. But there's now a lot of derivative stuff on top of async.io.
One thing we talked about during that flow control episode.
Yeah.
There's another library.
I forget what it's called already. But yeah, which adds a better interface.
Async await is everywhere.
It's one thing that I feel bad about just developer communities, and particularly in JavaScript, how long it took. Like how much support there was for promise objects and how long it took to get a fucking promise object in the language.
Oh yeah.
And then as soon as it's there, then people are like, well, we're bored of this. Let's make something new. Yeah.
After that, it was like, oh, hey, there's these generator things. Let's use those.
Yeah. Yes.
And then it was like, oh, let's do async await. And I don't like async await.
I don't either. I mean, before promise objects were in the language, all you could read about was about how all of the next level developers are using promise objects. And here are all the promise libraries you can use. It's way better than arrow code.
Yeah, yeah.
And then once it's in the language, then people are like, man, promise objects, they suck. They make your code awful. You got all this chaining. Wouldn't it be better if we had a keyword?
Yeah, right. But I think the thing about async await is like, it's almost, it feels so ubiquitous. Like even like Rust, there was a proposal, I don't know if it's actually in yet, but I had an async await thing, like it's like in a lot of languages, so it's like this common thread. So I get it, but I still don't like it.
I would still rather write promise objects myself.
It's tricky. Like I'm thinking in Python, like with Django channels, you specifically have to do async stuff in there, and so you have the async and await.
Yeah,
and what sucks is keeping track of it, because you could put those anywhere and then potentially use an async function inside of synchronous function and get an error, you know? And so, that's...
And Django's still, like, very tightly... Well, not tightly coupled, but it's a pretty strong assumption that you're working with a relational database. Database driver, like, asynchronous database driver support in Python is... It's there. I mean, there are some that do it, but for the most part, when you're interacting with a database, you have blocking code.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you can't really be async in that case.
So you have a helper function to make async call synchronous for the database. Yeah.
Things like that, that you have to do in Python because it's interfacing, is particularly in developing with the Django framework, because there's so many places that are interfacing that don't give you any, that make very safe assumptions because you couldn't do async stuff 3 years ago.
Okay.
They very safely assume that everything is synchronous.
Got
so
it.
You have to jump through some hoops.
Okay.
So part of it is that. What makes it hard in Python is you cannot assume that other libraries have any sort of support for asynchronous behavior.
Yeah. Okay.
Because they may predate the existence of that in the language.
Yeah.
right? Because we're on like 3.7 now.
I think so 3.8 is in like alpha or pre-release or something.
I'm running 3.7.4 actually right now.
Oh, it's in beta. Beta 3. Mm. When's it coming out? We get to do another release notes episode. Python 3.8 release notes.
I'm not even real sure what all was doing 3.7.4, but I installed it.
I don't even know what was added to JavaScript this year.
Well, that's because there's been 15 releases. With. Yeah.
Yeah. What are you guys on? Like Node 57 now?
I think 12.
It's 12. It's 12.
I'm looking up release date for 3.8. And it's a really convoluted document for just a date. Mm. Final. Ooh, yep. October 21st.
Mm.
So shit. Coming up, couple months away.
That's awesome.
We'll be exploring that.
Yeah. Yep.
But yeah, so there's a couple things in JavaScript.
Anything cool?
Are you looking these things up?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so there are some cool things, actually. A lot more of the, you know, they're adding more of the collection type functions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a standard library. I saw that every was on array now. Mm-hmm. I was like, what?
Yeah, it looks now there's like flat map and...
Mm. That's cool.
And flat and... There's some
it's like the
optional catch stuff, so you don't have to include the error parameter if you don't want it.
Sweet. It's like they've started including the Ruby standard library.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's JavaScript, right? It's an amalgamation of so many languages.
Pretty much.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah.
I don't keep up with JavaScript improvements. I just wait for them to trickle down. I just wait for them to show up.
Wait for them to break something in my front end.
Yeah. I wait for it to show up in Stack Overflow answers to questions about the front end framework that I'm using. When it's in the view tutorial.
Yesterday. What's happening today?
That's when I learned about it. So I've always been like super late adopter on JavaScript stuff. You would laugh. Like you would have a field day. Watching me make JavaScript discoveries.
That should be a podcast at some point.
Yeah, because I'd be like, oh shit, what's this thing with the whole fucking, what's this little arrow do? You know, like,
yeah.
That's cool.
There was something
I remember I was showing in Vue X on a project that we did and then blew everyone's mind with the, because I had the arrow function and then it was a way to, like I was assigning a variable to an arrow object. Function and then passing in, you know, a variable and then the arrow function. So you have two equals on the side of the variable going in and looked really weird, but yeah.
It's like cool.
go ahead.
There's nothing more satisfying and I think for in any language is like totally blowing someone's mind with like, oh yeah, that's cool, but like did you know you can do this?
Yep.
I love that shit. Yeah.
It's so anti-Zen of Python of there should be one and only one way to do everything. Yeah. I'll tell you something that I really like that's just shorthand sugar that I would totally welcome in Python is like, in Python it wouldn't be objects. It'd be like a dictionary or hash map, but like assigning a variable...
That's the same name.
And keying it, it's the same name as the variable.
Yeah, man.
Because there's so much of that
so
shit.
Good.
Of like string, colon, string.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or the dot get, you know, and then pass in your default. But it would be really nice to, just dot my thing.
Yeah, that too.
That one is good. The other one that like I feel like people traditionally like or usually don't know about is like the with an arrow function you can implicitly return a function. You don't have to have a return statement.
Oh, yes. Right.
So
yes.
After you nice.
I think I know that, but only because it's a standard convention in Vue.
That
a lot where you'll assign a function to some property on the component.
Yeah, so you'll do like arrow parentheses and then an object inside and it like if you have a parameter called dogs, you can just put dogs in the object and it'll just pass it right through. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So good.
You can thank CoffeeScript. CoffeeScript in the Rails community.
Yeah, interesting.
For arrow functions in your JavaScript.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good.
What was his name? The guy he wrote CoffeeScript and Backbone.
Oh, Backbone.
Yeah, the guy who did CoffeeScript did Backbone as well.
I never got to use Backbone.
Man, I was looking at a thing.
As soon as I was reading about Backbone and going like, yeah, this is cool, then like I think Ember and a few others came on the scene.
Jeremy Ashkenaz. I don't know how to Ashkenaz, is that how you pronounce his last name? That's what I've got.
Jeremy Ashkenaz.
Ashkenaz.
Yeah. Backbone was the first JavaScript framework I learned.
And I've used Backbone a long time ago.
Yeah. I saw a company the other day that was still using Backbone.
Just writing that ship.
It's ancient. But I remember writing a router for it.
It was like a job on LinkedIn or something, and it was like, hey, you know, you're going to write React, but also have to support this Backbone thing. And I was like, whoa.
Oh, wow.
Whoa. Red flag. Yeah. I don't know which of the boxes that gets you an X on and like the Joel score, you know what I'm talking about? On Stack Overflow. Yeah. You familiar with the Joel score?
No, what's the Joel score?
Joel Spolsky. Joel on Software is his blog. He's one of the co-founders of Stack Overflow.
Yeah, and he's a hard ass dude.
He is, and he's got a rubric for measuring the quality of a software team, and when you post developer ads on Stack Overflow, it makes you fill out a questionnaire and gives the Joel score of it.
So we need
the Joel test.
We need to be bleeding edge. And also,
are you ready? Do you want to know the 12?
Yeah, hit it.
Yeah, let's do it. This is awesome. Yeah.
Speaking of vices, these are the 12 steps.
Yeah. Also, if you haven't read his blog, like, just read a couple and like
polarizing,
very polarizing. Yeah. Wow, that's a very tactful way to say it.
Yeah,
I was gonna say asshole, but yeah. But polarizing is
we
good.
Said the same thing on the first episode about what's his name.
Yeah,
we also were tactful, like, but now that we found our voice as a show, we right say, code motherfucker asshole. Yeah, what is that?
Oh,
I'm trying not to get too distracted.
Zed Shaw. I actually love that guy.
Polarizing. Maybe I like Joel. All right, you guys tell me. Number one, do you use source control? That's a healthy measure of software.
Yeah, I agree.
No to that, I don't want work there.
Well, let's extend that a little bit further. And do you use Git at this point? Like, if you use Subversion,
we use Mercurial.
Or fucking what's the Microsoft one that like
Team shit.
Proprietary to them.
Is that what that is? I've seen like ads for it but I didn't realize it was a version control.
There's VSTS, which is like their GitHub thing.
Yeah.
But for a while they had their own Git. I contracted for a company last year that used it. Painful, dude. Painful.
I can imagine.
That's the cathedral for you there. They're like, man, we need our own version control.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's one other source control system out there I think that has some merit, which is Perforce or Perforce?
I don't know that one.
It's used heavily in the game development.
Oh, okay.
And the thing about it, my understanding is it's much more performant when you're versioning really large files, like texture packs and things like that. Mm-hmm. That Git breaks down over.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like, you can't put.
We're talking about a gigabyte file in a
GitHub
repository. Oh, you can because we're doing it on a project.
Oh, fantastic!
But you have to have a.
Sounds like we're doing that one right.
Yeah. Well, it's not us doing it. It was a requirement of a data scientist giving us access to a repo. It's like, first install this Git extension that will let you install massive files or upload massive files.
Oh no, they have like their entire training data set under version control, don't they? We're gonna have to do the Joel test.
Help.
Yeah, that's why they hired us. We're here to help.
Yep.
Number two, can you make a build in one step? I feel like that's a dated question.
Can you make a build in one step, like build your application
in one
for deploying?
I feel like that might be a little dated.
I don't know that there's really a hard need for that to be one step.
Oh, you said a dated question.
Yeah, a dated question.
Oh, I thought you said a data question.
No.
Okay. Yeah. A dated question.
I mean, one step in as much as CI build like make a full build, but it's in multiple steps, and it's nice to make that testable.
I think what he's saying is like, do you have like scripts, a command that you can run to like if it runs multiple steps, that's fine. Yeah, to
app spit deploy.
out
Yeah. You have the app deploy script.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's so, kind of today, that's CI.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I get that. Yeah. I think about, like, you know, there's the for us, like, using Docker and things like that. Like, the idea that, like, part of making a build might be building an individual container of that service, putting that in a repository somewhere else. But when you actually deploy it, you might need to deploy multiple services, so on and so forth. Reasonable ask, I think. Number three, do you make daily builds? So this also, I think, predates modern CI flows, where you just remember going to download your favorite, you know, open source app on the net and go into the nightly build section.
Yep.
Because there was a Jenkins server that cranked out a build at midnight of just whatever the fuck was in.
I mean, that's still like how Chrome works.
Yeah, that's true.
And all of the browsers work that way. I think for web development, the equivalent of that is like, do you continuously use continuous
that's what I'm thinking. Like, do you have a build? This is every time you commit to master, do you have a build?
And I actually think that's a pretty controversial one. Because I feel like there are good reasons and bad reasons to do that is what I would argue.
Yeah.
I'm sure he would argue otherwise.
Yeah, probably. Number four, do you have a bug database?
I think
the implication there is like an issue tracker.
Yeah, which would be super shocking if you didn't have that in this era.
Yeah.
But that exists. I've worked for companies that
you just have project managers walk up to me like, hey, I've got stuff for you to do today.
Yeah. Here's a Trello board of all the shit we want built, and here's a Google Doc with like screenshots and drawings on it.
But if you have a Trello board, that's your database, right? That's your bug database.
In the particular teams that I'm calling out, not by name, only features were in the Trello board. Bugs were reported by the CEO sending you a PowerPoint that said, this shouldn't be like this. Yeah. That was the bug database.
Gotcha.
Emails and emails of PDFs and spreadsheets.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Number five, do you fix bugs before writing new code? I think that makes a lot more sense if you're a solo developer. But when you've got a team moving on stuff, see, that's where I start to disagree.
Yeah, I think I think that depends.
You don't need to stop the forward progress of a project because you have one bug.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think it depends.
It depends on how bad the bug is, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I think that's a good point. If it's critical, like if it's preventing users from doing something in the app, then absolutely it takes precedence. But
I think defining this like as a rule, we fix bugs for writing new code is a bad practice.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think it also makes a pretty aggressive assumption that there is software without bugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
It does.
Yeah. I mean, you can't continually create features.
We're building new features because our app is bug free. Yeah.
Yes.
So we're free to work on that. That's a really
good point. You really just have to prioritize which bugs are. We can't move forward until we fix these, or we shouldn't move forward until we fix these.
Because what's that old statement? Like the presence of tests does not mean the absence of bugs.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yes.
To me, this should say something more along the lines of, do you include bug fixes in every release? To make sure that they are getting attention.
Do you have a standard practice for addressing bugs?
Yeah, right? like those
kind of things.
Yep. Yep.
Do you have an up-to-date schedule? It's number six.
I don't understand what that means.
Like a roadmap?
We have Jira, you know.
It's agile, bro.
So no.
Yeah. I know what I'm working on this week.
Yeah.
And I'll be working on it next week if I'm not done.
Yeah, this ain't Waterfall. We ain't playing this shit out that far ahead. Like,
yeah.
Number seven, do you have a spec? I assume a technical spec. Again, that's very Waterfall-y.
It is Waterfall.
Like, do I have a spec on an individual feature? Sure. Do I have a spec for, does my team have a spec?
I have acceptance criteria.
I would love to evolve that question. As a developer, if I could ask every company, do you have, I usually market myself as a full stack developer.
Right.
And if I'm doing anything front end related, I want to know, do you have Photoshop files or do you have a designer or any kind of, do you have a spec for the features that I'm going to be working on, or do you have somebody who's going to come up to me and be like, but could you move that up
a few
pixels?
And could you,
design spec?
I hadn't considered design spec being what they're going for there.
That is one of my biggest pet peeves.
I would just want somebody to tell me what it should look like.
Yeah. Or being told, like, just put it on the page. Make it not look terrible.
Make it look good. Yeah.
More prominent. Can you do that? Can you make it more prominent?
And I'll even say, like, even for back end stuff, Most of the time, there's not a spec. Most of the time, it's like, okay, here's this data, and this is what we need to accomplish with it. And yes. there's no like actual written document in my experience.
True.
It's more like
that is our experience also in client services on a product team. Maybe it's more sophisticated.
Maybe.
You have like dedicated architects handing that shit out. You
but know? even but I agree. Like even if you're building like an API, for example, the first step is coming up with the spec for the API, and if it's
which is usually like written on a napkin over lunch.
Right. And then you're like, so does this look good? And everyone's like, it looks like, good to me.
Mean, looks like Jason to me.
And inevitably like that evolves. Like, and that's the thing is, you know, thinking about the solution with the information you know now, but also realizing that that's definitely going to change.
Yeah.
Number 8. Do programmers have quiet working conditions?
Oh,
fail at lofty last.
This is a thing. This is a thing that he is really passionate about.
Should get some headphones.
He has trouble concentrating.
So the Stack Overflow offices, like every developer has an office with a door.
Wow.
Sounds like a great
or it used to be
real estate luxury.
It used to be that way.
I would love to provide that for everyone. Do you know how much it would cost to have private offices for your employee?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we could get you broom closets.
Yeah,
I put some walls up out there, and
I think
get some cubicles. Yeah,
his argument, I think, if I remember correctly, is that in order to achieve like the deep focus you need to write software well, you have to be distraction free to kind of like walk down into that code cave. Which for you know, I actually somewhat agree with this one. When I work from home, sitting on my couch or in my office, I get a shit ton more done than when I go to the office and it's an open you know, working space. I'm probably like twice as productive.
I'm really jealous of you guys a little bit because I know Casey can relate.
I can't work from home.
The office is my quiet space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Part of it is, I mean, I have a 2-year-old at home, but I also, even before that, when I was working full-time remote, for the company I worked for out in DC, I rented an office here in town.
Yeah.
And that, I started lofty out of that office, but I had that office because I just couldn't work from home. So I would like get up at home, get dressed, drive to the office to sit there. But, and all my colleagues were in DC, but I just suck at working from home. That's a distraction problem more than a noise problem.
Mm-hmm.
And just like my personal issue. But that is a big concern. Just like tying that back to our business here, that's one of my biggest concerns for us long term as we grow in this particular office space is the noise level.
Yeah,
because I find that being a problem.
Yeah,
we're trying to balance like where do we put salespeople so that they can make a call without noise in the background, but also so they're not raising a lot of noise.
Right.
We have a pretty relatively small space. People are pretty close together. I find conversations popping up. What happened around Alex's desk yesterday? Like we came out of. We had 4 days on site with a new client, and so like we came out and they left the state, and so we're just like, holy shit, thank God.
Released the hounds,
really we annoyed. Came out and we, that and we office, did it, and like... we were just piled up right by Alex's desk, and then when we realized, it was like, oh, my bad, dude.
You guys are out here programming. Yeah.
Stack Overflow reminds me of this company. I can't remember the name of it, but they were really into remote culture and making the in-office experience feel identical to the remote culture.
Hmm. So it's kind of like a base camp type thing.
Kind of like a base camp where everybody had to wear headphones in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a meeting with anybody in the office, it had to be a video call.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they were
I like that perspective, not just for the noise control, but I feel like if you're going to do remote, that is so important that there's no such thing as a meeting or a type of conversation that only happens when you're within the confines of the office.
Yeah.
Like all those conversations need to be online. Otherwise, and I've worked remote for a lot of my career, you're on an island out there.
Yes.
And then you show up into a scheduled planning meeting and everyone's like, so we're doing this. And like, whoa, wait, I didn't hear about it. Like, oh, we were talking about it in the huddle room this morning. Shut up.
Yeah.
You know, and that is not, it's not a good culture.
Yeah.
I've always felt like if you're going to take any remote at all, you have to build everything about the day-to-day for the in-office people to function as if they're remote. I totally believe in that.
Yeah, same. I think it's great.
We haven't been successful at that, so we don't take remote people.
Yeah.
That's where we're at.
Yeah, so we have
remote. Not very good at it. Yeah.
You guys have the big remote culture.
I'm actually interested to hear Alex think thinks RevUnit does it remote.
How RevUnit does remote? Yeah. Like how well they do it?
Yeah.
It's so-so. It's not horrible, but it's not amazing either.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of the a lot of those meetings where you're only in the inn if you're in the office, kind of thing.
See, that's the problem that you want to combat is not having this caste system of the local people.
It is. There's definitely a preference for being in the office, especially for living in Bentonville, I think, and for being there. But I don't think that they discriminate against anybody who does remote because we are in the middle of nowhere and it is hard to find people. And they are also very lenient in hiring remote people or letting you work remote or from across the street at the coffee shop.
Yeah. So do they have any trouble making that feel equitable?
Equitable as in,
I assume that some people are full remote.
Yes.
And then some people are local and is it your choice to come in or is it like, if you're local, you should come in? And how does it feel for being someone that has to come in the office and there are some people that never have to come in the office?
Yeah, it's pretty equal and usually it depends on what team you're on. And the way RevUnit works is we have product teams that organize around specific projects.
Yep.
So if you're on, like, I just got off of a project that no one was here locally. And so I worked from home a lot. Like, for the past month, I've probably worked from home 90% of the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if I'm on a customer that's close or all the team members are here, I'll go to the office more. And in this in-between time where, I'm not on a new project yet, so I'm mostly doing internal stuff, I'll probably go to the office, 3 days a week. And to Alex's point, I think they do, they do a so-so job, I think, like you said, because there is still a lot of that office culture of having side conversations that just happens.
Yes.
Also, to Alex's point, there's not really like a hierarchy. I don't feel like remote employees are treated any differently.
Yes, they're not treated differently. You're not going to be like, oh, I don't want that guy on my team because he's remote.
Yeah.
The part that I wonder about is like being, if someone comes to Blake or hypothetically and said, hey, I need you in the office tomorrow.
Yeah.
Do you get this sort of like, well, what about like fucking so-and-so that never had to be in the office ever?
Oh.
Like those types of conversations.
Not really.
This is what I worry about as a manager, honestly.
Yeah.
Is more of a thing of making sure that we're applying rules equitably.
I think everybody understands.
And then I have a good answer when someone asks that question.
I don't mean to say anything bad about RevUnit. Because I don't mean anything by it. I would just assume, and I also don't have this experience. It's just a personal assumption that if you wanted to say like I want to be C-level in RevUnit, it would be very difficult to do that remotely. Yeah, you have to get any high level. But if you want to just do your job, then awesome.
Yeah.
When I first moved to Bentonville, they were I didn't have very many friends because I just moved there. Right. So I really enjoyed going to the office every day just to have that social aspect.
Yep.
Mm. And then the longer I was there, the more I would work remote. And then the more that I started to work remote, I realized, well, if they're this lenient, why don't I just start traveling and do that? And I did that. I traveled while working for a while as well. And it was usually on a per project basis.
Gotcha.
Where when the project was starting, I would stay in town and
be locally available.
Right. Yeah. Cause that's usually when the bulk of the meetings are happening
right.
is at the beginning. Yeah. There's a lot of planning. There's a lot of discussion. And then once we kind of know what the workload would look like, then I would start traveling and then I'm just pumping out code.
Right.
They don't care where I'm doing that.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I definitely agree with that sentiment. And anything above like director, which at RevUnit is like the manager level,
you'd probably got
to be going into an office regularly.
Right.
Mm. So quiet working conditions. No, that's good. That's good conversation for sure. That's again, one of the biggest things that I think about for our space as we grow is figuring out how to manage quiet working conditions. Mm. Cause like it can get noisy out there. And if we, you know, fulfill our hopes and dreams and double the amount of people working out of this office, that problem's only going to get worse. So
I have a really difficult time programming without headphones on.
Yeah.
Not because of noise, but if it were just really quiet or if there was light music playing and I had no headphones on, it would still be very difficult for me to focus.
It's like a comfort blankie.
Kind of. Like, I just need music directly in my ears,
straight
to focus,
piping straight. Yeah, to the dome.
So it also like dulls everything else. It doesn't, regardless of if there is something like happening in the background, just headphones just naturally dull other sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes like I will literally sit
with no music
with
on.
No music.
Just
oh my God.
I've done that.
I'm so glad someone else
yeah, dude.
Said that.
We've had several very safe moments on the show.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
I'll be like, oh, I haven't turned any music on. Weird.
I've done that. Like, I've watched a video on YouTube or something, and then that stops, and I'm like, okay, now I know how to do the thing. And then I'm doing the thing, and I got them in, and people are talking around me, and it's muffled. I'm just like, this is kind of nice.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right, I'm going to go quick through the rest of them. All right, so number 9, do you use the best tools money can buy?
Mm.
I feel like that's a status thing.
I just use open source.
Exactly.
Yeah, the best tools you can't buy. Because,
yeah. I feel like that one's a little vain. You know,
have
like,
you read his other blog?
I know, but it's just like a measure of the quality of a software team is like, you know.
Well, that's cathedral mentality totally right there.
Like, it feels a little Louis Vuitton.
I think
because that's like, what I used to think about programming. Like, well, to get into this, I'm gonna need a Visual Studio.
I got my first programming job. No joke. Paid awful. Didn't care. The ad that they ran was like, "Do you want to write code on a fucking Mac Pro G4, like fully spec'd out with a 30-inch Apple monitor?" And I was like, "Fuck yeah, I do." And they're like, "Cool, you're gonna make $4 an hour." And I was like, "Whatever," because working on that computer is worth infinite money to me. I was young, I was a big Mac fan, and it was never something I could personally buy. So I have been enticed by tooling like that before.
I'm gonna tell you, Casey, it didn't hurt anything.
That you got a MacBook Pro
here? Yeah. Definitely didn't hurt anything.
I guess that's true. We actually are using, as far as software development machines too, we're buying the most, we have the most expensive tools money can buy. I don't know if they're the best.
I think you need to check yes on that one.
That's true. That's the one I've talked the most shit about. Yeah. And the one we're like living all day, every day.
Fuck this guy, reading this
off of an iMac.
I use open source, but you know, yeah, that hardware though.
Yeah, that's true.
Dang, when you use open source to save money so you can buy more MacBooks.
Yeah.
And I think the sentiment though is like, are you
undercutting your developer's ability by giving half?
I think so.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I think that's what he's trying to get at, which is fair.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you're applying to a job and then the perception is, are they going to take care of me? Are they going to provide me the tools I need? Or are they going to go, why didn't you do it? And you're like, well, I needed the thing.
Yeah.
I'm writing code on this 10-year-old ThinkPad, motherfucker. Yeah. Like, come on.
Using text editor. Yeah.
Docker barely runs on this motherfucker. Come on.
Number 10, do you have testers? I can't really disagree with that. Dedicated testing is a luxury. I do think that. That's hard for us to do, is have dedicated testing.
But
we do dedicate testing into our workflow, but we don't have dedicated QA engineers currently.
That's a nice safety net if you can get
it. It's really good. I mean, that does. I think that does absolutely have a multiplier on the efficacy of a software.
Because I've heard someone talk about like, oh, I don't want to do that. Like, you know, you're writing the code, you should test it. And that's true, and we do, but you know, after you've been staring at that for so long, you can't see. I'm notorious for it with forms, especially.
You have tunnel vision.
Yeah, where I know exactly what I'm going to type into this to get it to work, and I don't even think about anything else after a while.
Yeah. Like, Got to put some letters where the numbers go.
Yeah,
I have mixed feelings on that one.
Okay,
I just think that I don't think that you should say like, particularly within the perspective of the Joel test is being given to like people who are trying to apply. You're paying money. It's like it's like $1,000 to run an ad for your software job, and then like you're paying all that money, and then they're like, this is a software job. It fucking sucks because they don't use the best tools money can buy. Like they score your job offer that you paid money to get. So that part's a little funny, but I don't think that you should count that, like the absence of dedicated testers, I don't think should be like, hey, you shouldn't go work there.
But the absence of dedicated testing should.
Yeah.
Testing. Yes. See, they say testers.
Yeah. If your company doesn't test your code.
Maybe also dated. This predates CI. Sure. Right? Or something like that.
Yeah.
Number 11, do new candidates write code during their interview? We don't make people write code during the interview.
You don't?
We talk code.
Yeah.
We talk concepts. We have them bring code samples. And we have a project that we have them do often, especially for junior developers.
I think that's fair.
So we do some skills testing. But we don't do whiteboard coding.
Yeah.
I don't sit over someone's shoulder and write code.
This is another thing that he is fucking hard ass about is he thinks that everybody should have, like, you shouldn't be writing software if you don't have a CS degree. You should be able to, like, invert a binary tree on a whiteboard. He is 100% that dude.
That's interesting. Whenever I read older books into that process and that mentality and think about, like, they're like, okay, now we're going to start a new project, everyone write out every bit of code and pseudocode first so they will know what we're going to write. Like, that's intimidating. I can't do that.
So I feel like when we interview people, I assume we're achieving the same ends there of measuring. Yeah. It's skills assessment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't actually have people write.
Definitely like to look at your GitHub and just see what you're working on.
I don't know. I mean, I could get behind the idea of something along the lines of a very small structured project of, like, as part of the interview process, like, here's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even here's some source code. But this is what needs to be done to it. Mm-hmm. And it's like I'm going to leave the room for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, not like I'm going to stand over your shoulder and be like, no, explain what you're typing. Yeah. Like, don't type that.
Well, because if I'm at that job, then I'm going to be all like, are you going to be over my shoulder the whole time?
So is this how,
like,
this goes?
Yeah.
I strongly dislike the testing or writing code in interviews. I've done quite a few of them, but there is one that I did really enjoy. And it was a pair programming one where you don't actually have to write the code.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to tell them what you want to write.
So you dictate the code.
The interviewer, he's writing the tests and writing the implementation. He's doing the typing, but you're the one who's telling him what we should do next. Mm. So you're talking through it. He's getting to see what your thought process is. And you can tell him the syntax that you would write. He's not just going to... If you can't think of the function name, whatever. But it was so basic anyway.
Yeah.
I was able to pass it, and it was in Java, which I don't know. Mm. So I was able to...
Yeah.
There you go.
I dig that, because that's sort of like what we were doing for our support engineer. Like, hey, tell us when you do a Google search, what happens? And we were trying to assess your understanding of web development in general, right? How deep can you go on that?
Mm-hmm.
And the last one, number 12, and the contradiction here is getting under my skin. Do you do hallway usability testing?
What?
Do you know what hallway usability testing is?
Throw my laptop down the hallway and see if it's in one piece?
Close. The definition is here. A hallway usability test is where you grab the next person that passes by in the hallway and force them to try and use the code you just wrote.
Oh, geez.
If you do this to 5 people, you'll learn 95% of what there is to learn about usability problems in your code. Mr. I need a door on my office and a super quiet workspace. Mm. Also expects to just snag people they're walking to get coffee.
Yeah,
and just get, like, ambushed. Your whole office experience is like, God, I hope no one notices I'm walking by.
Yeah.
And then someone's like, come here right now. I'm going to force you to test my
code. Come here, run this.
There's a strong contradiction in that, I would say.
Yeah, a little bit there.
I've never heard of that as a practice. I feel like that was when he bolted on the end.
So we do actually do something like this at RevUnit.
Is it formalized?
So
I'll tell you what we do. I go, hey, Alan, when you get it, or I slack him and say, hey, when you get it, come look at this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so when we build a product, and this goes back to the QA team thing, because like we don't have that at RevUnit either. Mm-hmm. When we're getting close to a release, like we actively pull in people that aren't on the project, mm-hmm. that have nothing to do with it, to run through the apps.
And to
solicit their feedback, to be like, what shit do you see in here that needs to be fixed or doesn't work the way you think it should, like. And we do that as we push up against the deadline, usually to like find bugs and fix little quirks and stuff. So
yeah.
To me, that's and then when we do QA, like everybody on the team is responsible for that. Mm. Like product owners, designers, mm-hmm. devs, mm-hmm. everybody tests the app.
So do you pull like a bunch of people in and like QA? Does everyone QA everything? Mm-hmm. Or is it just like get one person to QA and it doesn't matter who you get?
We asked for volunteers.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And usually you'll get 10 people.
Okay.
And
this is like on a per feature basis.
No, this is on a per release basis.
Oh, okay. See, we do that kind of testing, we do on a per like ticket basis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we don't do that.
So we have the PO, the developer peer reviews it, and then we have the PO actually review the individual task that's about to merge.
Yeah. It depends, but the validation happens typically at the end of like a sprint. You know, the PO will say yay or nay, but at that point it's already merged in. Like
really,
and it's usually like okay, it's merged. Is something wrong? Like. Cool.
Well, that's true. Actually ours merges too. Ours is merged at that point, usually to a like a staging environment.
Yeah.
So that the QA can like whoever's QAing it can.
Yeah, we did that too.
It's not on the developer.
It's not on master.
Machine.
Like it doesn't go to master.
Yeah.
We have that.
That's master is a really we do like the real like the Git flow is what we usually use. Yep. So we have a dev branch and a master branch and dev branch is what everybody looks at and works off of, and then the master staging is like a stable version of dev.
Yep.
So it's behind. And then when you're ready to go, you merge dev into staging and then dev into master.
Once that's QA'd, that goes to master.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that works. Like this idea of, the idea that you need dedicated QA testers is, I think you said a luxury and I 100% agree with that. And man, that job sucks. Like that, and that's my main thing with it is like, would you want to do that all day?
I have known people that seem to enjoy it.
I think it takes a certain type of person. I would never want to fucking do that ever in a million years.
Yeah.
Be like, oh man, another Monday.
Yeah.
Gonna put some non-UTF-8 characters in this username field.
Boy, yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
Work on my Selenium script.
Oh, it broke. I am sorry, QA testers.
We love you.
I appreciate you.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a harder job than I can handle.
Yes. That's my fault, not yours.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
So that's the Joel test. I don't even remember how we got there.
Well, that's where we ended up.
What a way to round out the episode.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what the theme of this one was.
Vices and 12 steps.
That's
12
right.
steps. Yeah.
Thank you, Alan.
Yep.
Well, we'll ask you at the end of every episode now what the theme was.
These episodes, but God, I can't name variables and shit. what are we going to call this thing? All right.
All right. Well, that was fun. Have a good weekend.
Thanks for listening to Friday Afternoon Deploy, recorded and produced by the team at Lofty Labs. If you enjoyed the show, you can subscribe to future episodes via iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. You can also follow @FridayDeploy on Facebook and Twitter for episode previews, live streams, and other behind-the-scenes peeks. Past episodes and show notes on this episode can be found at friday.hirelofty.com. That's friday.hirelofty.com. If you'd like to contact the show, or if you're local to the Northwest Arkansas area and would like to be a guest on the show, you can email us at podcast@higherlofty.com.